Okay, we have been dealing with the exile, right? We talked pre-exile. We just were finishing up the exile. Come up with a couple of just highlights from the exile that stick out to you, whether we're talking dates or developments, just what sticks out to you. Look at your notes. Cheat if you must. Mm-hmm. Yes, the exile contributes to the development of cultures, subcultures within the like the Babylonian culture that are distinctly different. The further away you get from the locus of power, the more you try to hold on to your identity. Good, Drew?
Along with that, the religious development that happens throughout that time, and how it makes people more open to what we see in the Old Testament compared to what we see in the New Testament.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yep. Religious development. So the Sabbath and kosher laws and good. Andrew.
We see that there's a lot of different kinds of wars that have been going on mm-hmm. in the last few hundred years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Intensity of a lot of different wars, a lot of jockeying for position, especially with this region right here. And we'll talk about that more even today, but good. Other stuff. Mm-hmm.
There was a division between the Samaritans and the Israelites when they came back.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the Samaritans and the Israelites, their division that carries over in the New Testament's already beginning 500 years before Christ. Good. Other stuff. Yep.
The status of the high priest increases. Mm-hmm.
Yes, the status of the high priest begins to increase, especially in the political realm, where it becomes this key intersection of politics and religion, especially with foreign leaders. Good. Other stuff? Key dates? Anything you're like, I probably should know that.
587.
Which was that one? Yeah, we better know that one. That's a big one. That's kind of like in the first century not knowing the importance of 70 AD. Mm-hmm. That's a big one. Yes, Jesse.
539 and 38.
Mm-hmm, which is? Yes, which is a big move. I mean, when the Persian Empire takes over and then allows the exiles to begin returning, 50,000 come, major shift. Good.
333, Alexander the Great defeats Darius III.
What a great segue into what we're talking about today, Andrew. 333, now we're going to be talking about the heavy intertestamental literature. We're really going to be focusing on the time period now for really probably the rest of this week into next week. On this time period of beginning around 333, although I told you I was giving you a date at the end of last class, and then we were going to take a couple of steps back, run towards that date, and then push beyond it. And that's what we're going to do here in a minute. But the Greek Empire will reign from around 333 until 164. So we're really covering almost 150, 200 years. And it's during this time period that some significant things begin to develop. Now, we'll hit the other 164 years as well, but Rome is really starting to emerge at that point, okay? So, 333 will be an important date, but we need to begin in around 338. 338, Philip II, King of Macedonia. That's why this map's up here, because we're going to be dancing on it. King of Macedonia. Here you see Macedonia right here. You see where its relationship is to Rome. Rome over here. So then you have Athens. This is Macedonia. Those of you that have taken Acts, Macedonia should not be confusing to you. 338, Philip II, King of Macedonia, unifies the Greek city-states. Unifies the Greek city-states. The reason why that's really important is because the Persian dominance, even into this region, the Persian influence, was really serviced by the inability for the Greeks to unify. See, Greeks were truly a democracy. Truly a democracy. We call ourselves a democracy in America today, but we're not. We're a republic. We have people representing our voice, but we don't really have a voice. We have a voice through who we vote for, but we don't have an actual voice. In the Greek Empire, everyone had a voice. So they even had what was called a bulatorian. And the bulatorian, you would come in, and all of the people within that city-state would be able to have a seat, and on any issue, they could speak into it, actually speak into it. Now, that's really great as far as the emphasis on the individual. It's very difficult to become unified with multiple Greek city-states if you have to have every single person give a voice. So what Philip II accomplishes, the king of Macedonia, is for the very first time, all of the Greek city-states unify under him. Philip II. So it is keeping democracy, but it is shifting more towards a monarchy / republic. However, let me just say, he unifies Thrace, Macedonia, and Greece. So you're talking the most important city-states of at that time, what was known as the Greek city-states, he's able to unify. Unfortunately, in 336, Philip II is assassinated. He was preparing, actually, to lead the United Greek city-states to launch an attack against the Persians. And instead of that being something that is accomplished, they assassinate him in 336. So, 336, his 20-year-old son, by the name of Alexander, who will eventually be known as Alexander the Great, takes power, 336. 20 years old. Let that sink in a moment. That's insanity. Especially because of what happens over the next, really, 6 years. It's unbelievable. But we'll get there. Initially, 336, the city-states try to revolt against Alexander. They realize very quickly that's a bad idea. Because not only is he militaristically genius, but he's also quite vicious. And so he suppresses the revolts pretty clearly. And by 334, Alexander is the undisputed king of the Greeks. So his dad dies in 336, he takes over power. People begin to revolt because they don't want some 20-year-old punk reigning over them. But in 334, Alexander finally put everybody on notice that he won't put up with that, and he becomes the undisputed king. Now, immediately what Alexander begins to do is once he gets all of this under control, he immediately starts to move against the Persian Empire. And we're going to see several moves that Alexander does in order to consolidate power. And eventually, this is where we're headed, eventually everything that is light is what he will take over. Okay? But we're getting there. Right now, we're over here. It's around 334. He begins immediately to move over into Asia Minor. That's his first move. Matter of fact, I think we're going to talk through like seven moves that he's going to make militaristically, which would be good world exam stuff. But first move, Asia Minor. Why is that such a great move? Well, number one, it's kind of your gateway over to the east. But number two, Asia Minor is rich in resources, big time rich in resources. So not only is it geographically an important location, but economically, it is very important location, Asia Minor. So he moves over there, 334. You can even see, and this is why I love this map, you can even see there's little handy dates that kind of guide us through there, which they are accurate. Because the very next thing is in 333, he ends up opening the door to Syria. Why is Syria so important? Remember, we've talked about this with my terrible maps on the board. Why is Syria so important? First of all, Syria, you can see it, it's right here. Now, Armenia is more up in this region, but this is Syria. Why is that such an important... Yeah?
It's a central point for getting into Egypt and then into the East as well.
Mm-hmm. Remember, we talked about this with some of the concessions that was made by the Persians. I mean, the Babylonians on some sense, but especially the Persians. Why would they allow Jerusalem to rebuild their temple or to fortify walls? Well, because it becomes a very important buffer zone between them and the Egyptian Empire. So his first move is not just to go Asia Minor and sweep across. His first move is going to take over Asia Minor and then go down to Syria. That's his first move, which makes sense. So he then, 333, opens the door to Syria. And then in 332, it takes 7 months. And the reason why that's important is because of how quick he moves thereafter. 7 months, from January until July, it takes 7 months to take over Tyre. 7 months, one city. He lays siege to it, eventually takes it over, and when he does, he basically slaughters everyone in Tyre. Why? Because he doesn't want each of the cities he's going down to deal with to be taking 7 months. He needs to send a message. Yeah, this one may have taken a long time, but this is your fate. And he wipes them out. He goes down, keeps going down south. Now notice, why is he moving down south? We've just mentioned it. Why is south so important? Egypt. Yeah, I mean, think about this. If you would skip Egypt and you would stretch all the way across here, all Egypt needs to do is to come straight up, cut you in half, and you're done. Instead, what he has to do is he has to go down to make sure that whatever he extends is going to be able to be preserved. So his initial move is to go south, to come down and take care of Egypt. So move number, I guess we can call this 3.2. But then he goes after Gaza. So you can see that on the map right after Tyre. He goes after Gaza. We're still in 332. And he lets them know what's up. But while he's moving down there, Samaria and Judea, they just switch allegiances to him. They're like, yeah, you're strong. We're not going to fight you. We're on your side. Forget the Persians. We're on your side. So they don't put up a fight. So he's able to move from Tyre straight down to Gaza without a fight really here, because they're like, you're way too powerful for us. So they just switch allegiances so he doesn't have to waste any resources on them. He sweeps down, deals with Gaza, keeps coming, and around 332, but 331, he ends up defeating all of Egypt. All of Egypt. You can see that. 331 right there in the middle. All of Egypt now belongs to him. And he also establishes Alexandria. Alexandria, Egypt, which is in Jewish history, not exactly necessarily in Christian history, at least on the surface of the New Testament. But Alexandria is a very influential Judeo-Christian city throughout the first couple hundred years, 300, 400 years of the church. Very important. Well, we'll see here in a little bit why that ends up happening, because once we get done with Alexander the Great, you'll see an influx of Jews in Alexandria. But he establishes the city of Alexandria right here in 331, named after himself, and there's a strategy behind that that we'll talk about later. So, while he is down here consolidating things in around 332, 331, Samaria up here decides, yeah, we're going to go ahead and kill the officer that you left here in charge of all of Syria. Samaria makes a move. They're going, we think that we can, maybe they're thinking he's down so far south that if we kill this official, that the Persians will come help us and realign us, because they really did help us out. So Samaria kills the Greek official in charge of Syria, and that was a major mistake. Because when Alexander comes back north, one of the first things he does is go straight to the city of Samaria and basically leaves no stone unturned. He wipes it out. He says, this is what's going to happen for anybody that doesn't pledge allegiance to me, undivided allegiance to me. And he wipes out Samaria completely, the city. Yes?
What year was that?
This, we're in, yeah, 331. Yeah, literally, what's crazy is his defeat, this is why I said Sidon, at the beginning of 332, takes 7 months. So we're halfway through 332. He will do all that I just described before October of 331. Like, it's ridiculous pace. Within about 12 months, he takes care of all of Egypt, comes back and wipes out all of Samaria. And he's just going to keep charging. So at this point, to put this also into somewhat of crazy perspective, at this point, he is what? 24? 25? Around there? So, he's out of control. In a crazy good way. Well, for the Greeks. Not necessarily for Christian ethics, but that's a whole other issue. So Alexander then begins to march north in Syria. Notice, you can even follow the line. It's still 331. North through Syria, and he immediately goes, crosses the Euphrates, and into Mesopotamia, into Babylon. So he is just marching his way through. October of 331, he defeats the new Persian army, or the Persian army that was there, and this is kind of Persia's last stand. He defeats them, 331, October of 331. And this is kind of Persia's last stand, okay? Then what does he do? Well, we're going to summarize this quick because none of this stuff is important for history, but it's not necessarily important for Jewish history. He goes and marches all the way to the Indus River, wiping out whatever cities that he finds. Matter of fact, he marches through modern-day Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, all the way to the Indus River. And as history says, he gets to the Indus River and he says, there's no one left to conquer. It's like, I've conquered everybody. But you can even just watch. And he does this with incredible rapidity. I mean, the rapidness or rapidity with which he does this is startling. Startling. He's on his way back by 326. 329, not exactly, but 326. That's crazy. To go to do all of this in about 8 to 10 years. This is something that actually, the reason why this is important too is because of what some of the Roman emperors do in the first century, of what Alexander the Great, or what Julius Caesar actually had in mind whenever he started his great move to the east before he was killed on the Ides of March. I mean, this was what was in his mind. Because this is something that's just unparalleled in modern history. Unparalleled. Yeah. Oh, you guys are just giving me wonderful questions that lead right into the next section. Key developments during this time period will answer that question. How does he keep rule when he's marching all the way over here? Let me give you the summary answer and then let me give you the details. Summary answer is this. Because he is not just conquering or gathering new lands. His goal is to extend the land of Greece. There's a difference. His goal is not just to conquer and grab new lands, annex lands. His goal is to take what Greece is and to expand it. Now, if you are the Greek city-states, and that's what's happening, he's not merely just going out and gathering things. He's expanding what it is that you are. There's a part of that his success actually elevates your success. So there are several things, though, that he does along the way in order to communicate that to even subjugated people. Now, part of it, you could see it even the strategy a little bit, where he's leaving people behind in charge. So Samaria, he leaves behind an official who is in charge of some of the stuff we're about ready to describe, and they kill him. He's doing that as he goes through, leaving officials aside, maybe even raising up different people in army or leaving part of his army here and there. But he's got a strategy to expand Greece and not just to gather other lands. And what is the strategy? Well, several things. Number one, language. Language. Part of expanding Greek culture is expanding the Greek language. And what they would do, and this is very important for dominance. If you take my Roman history class, we talk a lot about this. But language is a weapon of empires. It's not just that they, this is the language we talk. No, it is political. Language is always political. And this is seen through basically any empire you can think of. Matter of fact, in the Greek or the Roman Empire, it was embarrassing publicly if an emperor would speak or even would claim to know the Greek language publicly. Why? Because the language of the Romans was Latin. Although, to be flat out honest with you, Greek is, frankly, it's a way more accurate language than Latin. Latin, there's a lot of ambiguity. Not as ambiguous as your Hebrew or your Aramaic. Good Lord, Hebrew and Aramaic. Aramaic is, I mean, they don't even have any, vowels. It's just straight consonants. So that causes a problem. So the Greek language is an upgrade. But language is a dominant weapon. You put language onto people. Let me just give you an example of this. Think about the way in which, not you necessarily, but some people that you know of, talk about people that come into America. What is expected of them if they come into America? You better speak English. But what's not? What do we not expect when we go to any other country? To speak their language. Why is that? Like, there is an arrogance to that because there is a perception. As a matter of fact, anywhere you go in the world, they speak more than one language, except America. You see this in this? There's a part of it we're going, we expect for you to speak our language, but we don't care to speak yours. That's never the way. That's never the way any other place in the world functions. But there is something being said by that, of what we think that we are. It's a weapon. Is this making sense? So, for example, whenever you have what was known as Serbia and Croatia, although I'm not going to get into the different stuff there, but the Serbs and the Croats were not friends. I mean, you talk about a vicious, vicious war. And once they started to separate themselves from each other, the first things both of them began to do was to purge words that had its origin in the other people, in their other people's language. So if you're a Serbian, you're going to purge all of the words that have a Croatian etymology, a Croatian origin. Why? Because language is war. Think about inside of this country, even with, a matter of fact, this is the origin of rap music. This is the origin. Is language that is put onto people that were being subjugated is then being used in a manner in which the people that pushed the language onto them now understand but don't completely understand. It's a way of regaining identity. To purposely not speak grammatically the way it is, and I'm using quotation marks for those of you that are listening, grammatically the way it's supposed to be spoken is a way of regaining dignity whenever language was being impressed upon you. Language is a weapon of dominance. It always has been. And this goes all the way back to Alexander the Great. First thing he's doing whenever he's going into these new places, immediately start teaching them Greek language. Why? Because the language that you speak defines who you are aligned with, what your allegiance is. You speak the language of the people you belong to. Is this making sense? You guys follow me? Question. Well, eventually it will be down here. Once we are not the new, you said New Testament. Yes and no. The New Testament would be more the anecdotal result of Alexander's movements here. And I mean, in other words, the Roman world was so profusely wedded with the Greek language because of Alexander's successful education system, I guess is the way I could put that, of educating people in the correct language. Now, the Septuagint becomes as a direct result, because remember we talked about this when we were doing the sources. The Septuagint, where was it written? In Alexandria. Because in that region, there was a strong influx of Jews in the region, and they all spoke Greek. It's one of the very first things that an empire does when they go into a new region is they set up an education system. I mean, in the Roman history, we talked about the reason why they do that is because it's hard. You can't always be using brute force. Alexander even though he does amazing, it's unparalleled for a reason, is because brute force is a resource that has a limited quantity. And if you are only reigning or trying to keep all of this under wraps with just a weapon, with just a sword, eventually you won't be able to hold it all. So what do you need to do? You need to educate people so that they buy into your myths, so that they buy into your propaganda, so that they understand your communication of different things so that they know to be afraid in the right settings. If you do not do this, and you do not have fear as a weapon to keep people where it is that you need them to be, then on some level you're going to run out of resources and the people will revolt and you will fall. You cannot use just brute force. Is that making sense? In other words, we talked about this before, I think in here, but it's the same. This is a military concept that I wish Christians would also understand today. But there's two ways to deal with an enemy: to eradicate them, to obliterate them, or to convert them. You know what I mean? If either one of these happens, they are now your enemy no longer exists. And what the Greek Empire will do at times, like with Tyre or with Samaria, they will obliterate them. But what you also need to be able to do is to convert them. Because if you obliterate everyone on this map, then you have no one to reign. And there's no way you'd be able to do that anyway. You don't have enough resources. Is this making sense? You guys follow me? Okay, question or comment?
So can you define, you said earlier, he wipes them out. What does that mean? By going to all these cities and like wiping them out?
Which ones are you talking about?
So like, for instance, you said he wipes out Samaria as he's going through this tour. What is that? Is he sparing people and then educating them, or what does that look like?
Maybe some. But not necessarily. And we see this in the Roman Empire as well, with the way that a Corinth or a Carthage deals with the Romans after Rome has even destroyed everybody, or well, has subjugated the Carthaginians after the Second Punic War. You have Corinth, who is over further away. Well, you can't really see them on this map. But they're over there kind of down in Achaia, so you're down in this region. So Corinth, whenever Rome takes over, they end up killing the Roman official. Well, if Rome lets that go, like, delicately punished, then what's going to happen with the rest of where Rome is dominating? People are going to start doing this everywhere. So what does Rome do? They go into Corinth, and they, like I said before about Samaria, they do not leave a single stone unturned. They decimate the entire city, wiping out everyone and anybody that's left, putting them into slavery. They do not leave anyone left to send an example. As a matter of fact, the ancient world, whenever Rome did that, they called it the new wisdom. That Rome was giving the new wisdom, putting everybody on notice. If you mess with us, we will wipe your city out of history. You have to do that to be a superpower. Now, do not hear me. Hear me. I'm describing history. I'm not giving value statements. I'm not saying this is a good thing. I'm saying this is, if you're going to be a political superpower, you have to have a demonstration of unparalleled power, of unparalleled dominance. And if you do not have that, the rest of the world will not bow its knee to you. It's not possible. So what did Alexander do? Well, first of all, he's sweeping down pretty quickly. Tyre was kind of a problem for him. 7 months for a Tyre? Tyre is nothing compared to like a Babylon. Tyre is nothing compared to some of these other cities. 7 months? So whenever he gets inside of Tyre, what does he do? He slaughters everyone. And anybody that's left over, he's not going to educate them. He subjugates them, put them in slavery. Why? He had to send a message of dominance. And it was a message that lasted about a year. He goes down to Egypt, but then Samaria ends up trying something against him. We're going to kill your official. They do. If he doesn't deal with them violently, then he's still communicating weakness. So what does he do? He walks up and decimates the whole city of Samaria, wiping them out. And that's what I mean. It's this demonstration of dominance. Now, it doesn't mean they can never be rebuilt. Although whenever the Romans did this to Carthage, they also took salt and they dumped it all over the city so that their land would even become infertile. To say, not even this land will produce fruit anymore because of what you have done to us. These demonstrations of dominance must be clear so that it can send a message of fear. Because if you don't have fear as an ally, you cannot be a successful empire. I mean, and we're noticing this, by the way. I mean, well, I shouldn't say we are noticing. That's presumptuous that we all are. We should take notice. Maybe I should say it like that. That's exactly what's being sold in America right now. And this is... fear sells better than sex. Way better. I mean, that's what this entire election was. The whole election on both sides was who can get their people more afraid of the other person. And whoever can get the other people more afraid, then they're the ones that's going to gain the power to do whatever it is they want. And this election, although it was the most insane, most ridiculous thing that frankly has ever been in American history, the most ridiculous, the ratings of the debates were the highest that they have ever been. Why? Fear sells. Now, fear is a dangerous bedfellow. Because it has a wage and it will collect on it. And you get people ramped up in fear too much for too long, and the consequences are more than just dire, they are devastating. The only way to really assuage this or to fix this is the people stop being so afraid. Every election, whoever it is, especially the last, man, basically almost all your all's lives, the elections were not like this in the 90s. They were not like this. It was after 9/11. Every election was laced with an intensity of fear that I'm going, when is this going to break? When is this going to break? I mean, think about the slogans that have won the last several elections. Hope, change, make America great again. The undercurrent of each of those slogans is fear. This concept of change. Why do we need change? Because we're going down the tubes. Why do we need hope? Because we're in dire straits and we need to be able to grab onto something that's beyond us. Why do we need to make America great again? Because it is not great, because we are going down the tubes. Every one of them is laced with fear. And every one of them, our country as a whole, is buying into it hook, line, and sinker. Fear is an ally for an empire, but as Alexander the Great, as the Romans will even indicate, eventually you can take fear only so far and then it turns back and devours you. So we're pushing it to the limit. And what I'm saying is what if fear doesn't sell anymore? What if Christians took it seriously in the passage where it says perfect love casts out all fear? And what if we started doing that? What if whenever they sell fear, we say, we understand that you're in a frenzy, but we're not? I mean, one of the biggest mistakes I think the older generations have done with your generation is be afraid of your generation. It's a major mistake. Because whenever they've been afraid of your generation, you know exactly what they have done. They've mischaracterized who you are. And they've taken any weakness they can even sniff out. Usually the weakness is one of their greatest weaknesses that's projected back onto you. Sorry, that's just the way it happens. But then they exaggerate it and get a caricature, and you guys are described as something that, frankly, I don't believe that you are. But how did it get that way? Is because we know the language of fear better than we know the language of faith. That's why. It's the reason why in church, I refuse, whenever I preach or disciple, to use fear as a way of motivating the congregation. I find that to be just as damning, just as damaging, as guilt and shame to motivate a congregation. Because guilt and shame are actually really closely related to fear, by the way. Think about that. Your guilt and your shame, you're worried or afraid of being cast out somewhere, set aside, that you don't belong. Guilt and shame are kissing cousins of fear. I refuse to use those weapons. Why? That is not how Christ woos us. Like people are drawn to God primarily and more long-term by painting the picture of his glory and beauty and pursuit and love of us. There is something intoxicating about knowing that there is somebody desperately in pursuit of you. Especially when you've come from a broken home where no one was in pursuit of you, where you were just an ornament on the wall. And for some reason, we think in the church that that won't sell. That won't grab a hold of people. And I'm going, no, here's the problem. Number one, it does take longer to get people to buy into that because you're having to push through so much fear and guilt and shame. But when that grabs a hold of someone, it doesn't easily let them go. If you convert people through fear, eventually something else will make them more afraid and then they will bail on faith. If you're negotiating in fear, we will ultimately lose. Which shouldn't surprise us, that in order for a political empire to stand, it must have fear as its ally. But when I'm describing the church of Jesus Christ, the kingdom of God, I'm saying fear is never its ally. That shouldn't shock us, that it's a contrast and not a correlation. Shouldn't shock us. Of course it's going to be different. I mean, what was Jesus doing in the Gospels? 365 times in the Bible it says, do not be afraid. One for every day. Do not be afraid. And yet, man, in the church today, every election, the Antichrist is elected. Every election. Read Facebook. I mean, right? It's going like, goodness gracious, we're fear dealers. We're fear dealers. That's all we deal. We don't know another language. And as a result, the church has lost its identity and it doesn't know who it's fighting and it doesn't know how to win. Because when you're afraid, you swing at everyone. You swing at everyone. As a matter of fact, you know, this is a counseling thing. Whenever you come in contact with fear, usually you're going to fall into one of three categories. You're going to do the fight, flight, or freeze. These are the three options. Fight, flight, or freeze. And I'm going, which one of those options, or even one that we would go, yeah, that's the one we want for Christians to be constantly speaking the language of? Where is sacrifice and love and grace in those three? Oh man, whenever we're like just picturing this God, this is honestly, I know the sermon. What is it, Jonathan Edwards, the fall into the hands of an angry God? I'm like, yeah, I think that's a terrible way of converting people. I just think it's a terrible way. I'd much rather somebody convert through the prodigal son. Because it grabs a hold of them in a way that fear can never touch. You know what I mean? Yeah.
So, does the Greek Empire or the Roman Empire ever try to move the other way? Try to make them fight them instead of just fear them?
Yes. And that's new movement too. You guys are just literally amazing today. Okay? So, language. But then Greek culture also smothers them with luxury. What you do is you make them so afraid because you're dominant, or you make them fall so deeply in love with you that you never want anything else. So the second thing that a Greek official would do, he would come in an education system. Second thing he would do is he would start building Colosseum, hippodromes, like sporting event type situations. Hippodrome is more Latin, so sorry about that. Well, kind of. It comes from Greek, but gymnasiums where you're giving, like the concept of the Olympic Games. You know, that's the reason why it was in Athens once it was kicked back up is because it began there. It's this competition where they would actually have all the city-states come together as a unifying thing in honor and worship of a god, which I always think that's interesting. It's like, you want to know why they light the torch at the beginning of the Olympic Games? Is because it is a cultic ritual in honor of the Greek gods. But we just, we just kind of worship something else in those moments. But they would do temples and theaters and gymnasiums, stadiums. They would do things to smother them, to anesthetize them with entertainment. Because if you're trying to subjugate a people, you want them to do really one of two things. I mean, getting them to love you is pretty hard. But getting them numb or getting them afraid, those aren't as hard. You can do those two things. Numb the people or make them afraid. You can do those two things pretty easily. You numb them by smothering them with so much entertainment that all of life revolves around entertainment. I mean, should we take a moment and let that parallel sink in with us? I mean, just should we do that for a minute? I mean, who are our national heroes? Let me say it like this. Name 10 presidents. You probably could do that. Name 10 sports figures. I bet you almost anyone can do that. I mean, who gets paid the most money? Not the president. Who gets paid the most? Sports figures. You know what I mean? Is this not true? What dominates the ratings on televisions in America? Sports. It's the reason why they're paying billions of dollars per basketball team to have the rights for that team's home games on a television station. And when I did use the word but as in billion. I mean, it's why is it that that NBC will pay $4 to $6 billion, what is it, 8 years ago or so, for the Olympics? It only comes around every 4 years. Well, I mean, every 2 years, I guess, if you count the Winter Olympics. But who does? The whole point is, why are they paying that much money? Man. Or and I haven't even added in Hollywood. If you're like, well, I don't know anything sports. Okay. Do you know any Hollywood celebrities? Or music? Come on. The major categories of the people that make the most money that everybody knows is entertainment. If you want to get a people to do what it is you want. Why is it that all the politicians are having LeBron James and Beyonce endorse them? Why? Because you either need fear or numbing. And that's what the Greek Empire is doing. They're using language as a weapon. They're then using entertainment as a weapon to anesthetize the people. Because how are you going to keep this diverse of a group of people all on your side whenever you're out fighting wars all the way over there? You either make them so afraid that you're going to come and wipe them out, or number two, you make them so in love with the mirage of the Greek Empire, of all the benefits, that you would never think of going back. So they're pumping money into their cities, building all of these things that bring Greek culture, but also anesthetize them, make them numb. This is like political dominance 101 is basically what I'm giving you here. Because here's the third movement, Greek religion. Like, you're going to need to tap into every area of a human, of what makes them human. So fear is a part of it that makes them human. You also have this entertainment aspect because we enjoy, I mean, and what's funny is that actually underneath every single one of these is a greater attribute of God that in its purity is holy, but used by empires can be damaging, destroying, destructive. Greek religion, because inside of all of us, we long to worship something beyond ourselves. So what would they do? Under Greek religion, there are three categories of religion that the Greek Empire, that Alexander was spreading. Number one, you have classical Greek religion. This is your Olympic deities. And so I'm not going to get into this too deep. Take my Roman history class. But you're going to be having all kinds of narratives, all kinds of myths that are going to be saturating the culture. So from Zeus to Apollo, Aphrodite, you're going to be pushing all of these types of myths. Why? Because it gives people something to aspire to or to worship, which is why temples were prominent throughout the empire. You didn't just put a temple anywhere. You put it at the very locus of power of the city to describe, hey, follow your religion. That's now who you belong to. You also had mystery religions. These were religions that were more like secretive cultic groups. Often, you know, you have a prominent initiation rites and festivals and parades, but they're more, you choose to be a part of these. You get to choose between to be a part of a mystery religion, whereas the classical Greek religion is something you're just, that's now a part of your identity. And then the third one, and this one is kind of a mixture, a hybrid of both you choose, but it is also imposed, is emperor worship. Emperor worship does not begin with Rome, it begins with Greece. Emperor worship, worshiping the emperor or your king as a god. And I'm using the word emperor there anachronistically because that's not what they would have called Alexander. But it's the imperial cult, worshiping the emperor as a god. And you give them a unifying religion, and that unifying religion allows them to pledge their allegiance to you in a different way. So eventually, especially if the emperor is a god, if you are rebelling against the emperor, you are actually waging war against the very gods that you owe your existence to. And that makes rebelling against him a little more difficult. You see how that works? What is the purpose of all this? It's exactly what the question that was asked earlier. In order to unify a diverse group of people, especially whenever you don't have an army in every single city. Why? Because you don't have enough resources for that. Especially you're going to push all the way to the Indus River, you're going to have to do other things. So what does he do? He spreads Greek culture. The number one political weapon that Alexander knew how to use was Greek culture, and he did it well. To the point where whenever we even get to the time of the Romans, I mean, they're reigning, by the time of the first century, they're reigning for 150, 200 years. They still couldn't eradicate all of Greek culture because Greek was really good at culture, like philosophy. Shoot, even to this day, If you want to go into philosophy, you need to study Aristotle, Socrates, Plato. These are Greek philosophers. And part of the Greek philosophy was the culture that they are pushing. Even if you're going to be studying, you know, government, political science, you're going to need to study the Greek Empire. Now, also the Roman Empire, because they build on the Greek Empire. But when it comes to philosophy, Rome really doesn't have a ton of great philosophers. I mean, you could point out like a Seneca or something like that, but nothing compared to the Greeks. Why? When it came to culture, Greeks were amazing. Amazing at pushing their culture. They were just, they were city-states, and so eventually they start to sever. And we'll talk about that in a minute. Yeah.
Was their culture so well developed by the time that Alexander got on the scene and then he ushered in the golden age, or was it like they're kind of making it up as they're doing it?
It's a both and.
Okay.
There was already a strong foundation. It's not like Alexander was having to create Greek culture and then disseminate it. Especially because of the city-states, so in the unification of the city-states, you start having a greater coalescing of a lot of different areas of culture. And so by the time that he's going to be disseminating all of the culture around, it's developed to a certain extent. But no, it also, as it incorporates all these other diverse things, engages new questions, it ends up taking on a different type of flesh than what it had even whenever he began. So it's a both and. Yeah. Like Arabia, like where are you like down here? No, it's hard to see, but topographically, can you guys tell the difference? That's all desert. And so it's a lot of what you have down here functioning in this region is a lot of nomadic. But when you're in the desert, you're not going to just hunker down in one spot. You're going to be moving to water sources. The way that you do your flock, everything's different. Arabia doesn't really have, number one, the terrain. Like, even notice, if you look topographically, you don't have, like, tons of major water sources here. Not like over here at the Nile where you have all those tributaries. You come over here, it's pretty barren, which is the reason why the Jordan River becomes a good barrier, because there's nothing over here. But when you go north, that's why you have to go north through Syria, up through Armenia. But notice that now here, you have the Euphrates and the Tigris, which create this very fertile basin. But over here, you don't have that. So even, I'm not saying there are not people down there. I'm saying who they are, though. No, they're not a threat. Now, they might be a threat for many raids on some of the cities down here. But you're not going to have a threat for an empire that's all the way over here. It's not going to work like that. Yeah, last question. I think we need to stop. Oh, no, I'm sorry. We need to stop. You can ask me after class, though.
Okay.
All right. Love you guys. See you in the morning.